So this is, of course, in the case of muscular rigidity, it turns out that there's basically one point. There are no deformations of the of this homomorphism. I should say that really some deformations of this homomorphism don't do anything. You should quotient out by conjugacy, because those kind of correspond to a change of coordinate system rather than to anything interesting. But anyway, so that was a general remark. It was one of the things that came up in an early lecture was the possibility of using non-compact three manifolds in physics. And as I said, I forgot all my physics, but I do know that there are dangerous things with non-compact manifolds. And so one of them is the Whitehead manifold. So this is a three manifold. And it has the property that it is not Euclidean space. It's not R3. But if its Cartesian product with the real line is R4. And so that's a bit worrying. So in some sense it's a fake R3. And actually what's going on here, well, so first of all, this is fairly easy to describe. What this manifold is, this manifold W is, you start off with a solid torus, and then you put that solid torus inside a bigger solid torus, and you put that solid torus inside a bigger solid torus, and so on, and you keep going forever. The only catch is that the way you put the solid tori inside them, the next one, is not the first thing you would think of. The first way you would think of putting one solid torus inside another solid torus would, well, it would just go around kind of inside like this. And if you do that, and you take this increasing union, you just end up with a very obvious thing. You end up with a very big solid torus. You end up with S1 times R2. So instead of that, actually, you do the Whitehead embedding. So you put in the solid torus like this. So the point is about putting V1, what I've drawn here is a curve, but that curve is actually a skinny solid torus sitting inside another one. And the point here is that if you had one more dimension to play with, for example, if you take the Cartesian product with the real line, you can undo this clasp here. And if you undo the clasp, you've got one sitting inside the other in that way, and it's kind of easy to see that if one sits inside the other in a simple way like this, that the increasing union would just be R3. So you've got these tori sitting inside the next one, always in this pattern, and it has the property that if you have another dimension to play with, you product with R, it can all be unknotted and you get R4. But the surprise is this is not R3. And the point is that its W is not tame. So I need to say what tame is. Tame means it's not what you think it is near infinity. So a manifold is tame. So an N manifold, M, is tame basically, if it's the interior of a compact manifold, if there is a compact N manifold, N, so that if you take M and remove any boundary it might have, what you have is the interior of N. So R3 is tame, so R3 is, after all, the interior of the three ball, the three disc. So it's tame. But this manifold is not tame. So I think it's safe to say there is no theory of non-compact manifolds. For example, recently Sylvain Maillot gave an example of a non-compact three manifold which doesn't have a prime decomposition. That's bad. of course, if you think about non-compact manifolds that are tame, that's good. And a recent triumph is the tameness theorem. So this was proved by Ian Agol and also Dunfield, wrong, and also Caligari and Gabay. And the tameness theorem says for hyperbolic manifolds, this kind of thing doesn't happen. So if you have a hyperbolic three-manifold, and it needs to be finite in an algebraic sense. In other words, a fundamental group can be generated by finitely many elements. It's finitely generated. So that you, if the fundamental group needs infinitely many elements to generate it, there's no way it could be tame. But if the fundamental group is finitely generated, then in fact M is tame. So for finitely generated hyperbolic manifolds, things are good. So last time I spoke about the classification of three manifolds, and if we believe Perelman, then there is a computer which will list all the closed three manifolds without repetition. There is also the recognition issue. The recognition problem is, it's all very well being able to list all the manifolds, but if somebody comes along with a manifold, you want to be able to say, oh, it's this one in the list. And again, if Perelman is correct, then the recognition problem is also solved. That is to say, you can recognize a manifold. You can decide if two closed, maybe I'll add the word orientable, three manifolds are the same or not.
Knowing what about them?
Just having any finite description of them, because you then can go away and compute the geometric decomposition, and from that you can decide. A special case of the recognition problem was known before Perelman. It was work of Abby Thompson and Chaim Rubinstein, who solved the recognition problem for a three-sphere, which is a kind of crucial case. That's sort of subsumed now in the geometrization theorem.
Perelman doesn't mention this, but you're saying that Ricci flow can be put on a computer roughly, and you can watch it break into its pieces?
No, you can't do that. But it is known, once you know that every closed three manifold has a geometric decomposition in the sense of Thurston, then that decomposition can be computed by other means. And in particular, if you have a manifold and you're told, a closed manifold and you're told it's hyperbolic, then Kasson and Jason Manning have an algorithm that will produce, which will compute in a very concrete way, the hyperbolic structure and so forth. So, as far as we know, Ricci flow is not computable. But there are other method algorithms that are computable. One of the important things, so there's, roughly speaking, the geometrization theorem or conjecture is the statement that every closed orientable three-manifold can be decomposed into geometric pieces. But a crucial part of that is a uniqueness statement. After all, every three-manifold can be decomposed into simplices. And the fact you can decompose something into simple pieces doesn't help you if you don't have some uniqueness statement. And so I want to talk a little bit about uniqueness issues.
In order to you have to stick together Abby's result and then some equivariant version of Abby's result for Lent spaces and so on. And you have to kind of compile a lot of separate theorems according to the geometries.
Yeah, although, you see, it gets easier. Once you know there are no fake three spheres, for example, if you happen to know your manifold is closed, irreducible, and simply connected. Well, how could you know it's simply connected? Once you know geometrization, you know all the three manifold groups are linear, and you can check that, and so you can decide the manifold is simply connected. Then you know it's a three-sphere. So once you know geometrization, in fact, you can work out all this stuff. I mean, you just... So, the...
Is there a reference
for what?
For this recognition problem following?
It's scattered throughout papers. There's a paper that does the hyperbolic case. It's on the archive. I don't know if it's on... It appeared somewhere. I think it might be in G&T. So Jason Manning was a student here. The paper, of course, by in the spherical case is Thompson... Abigail Thompson. Then Seifert fiber cases, there are more papers. There's one by Tao Lee. He does a Seifert fiber case. So it's scattered, I think. I don't think there's one paper that does the whole thing. And these papers were written before geometrization. So once you know geometrization, the results become stronger. This one and this one. I just want to talk about the uniqueness.
It's algorithmic to find the characteristics of manifold in the torus decomposition.
Yeah, using normal surface theory, and that work is due to I think Jaco and Rubinstein or somebody else. Yeah, it's algorithmic to find the JSJ decomposition. So I want to talk about the uniqueness of the prime decomposition. And it's kind of amusing. So a wonderful thing happens, actually, in dimension 3 that doesn't happen in high dimensions, and that is the prime decomposition is basically unique. But let's first of all think actually about the case in dimension 2. So let's think about all compact manifolds. So the compact manifolds form a commutative monoid, which means you can add them. And commutative, monoid. So you add them, and adding them means connect sum. There's an identity element, the sphere. If you connect sum anything with the sphere, it doesn't change. So it's a commutative monoid. And it's generated by three elements. There's a sphere, there's a projective plane, and there's a torus. And so anything is made of connect sums of the sphere, the projective plane, and the torus. But there are some relations. And of course, the first relation is that S is the identity. Meaning if you connect sum S with anything, S plus X is always X. And the second thing is that the connect sum of three projective planes is the same as the connect sum of one projective plane and a torus. So in some sense, the theory of, I should say, closed, no boundary. If you wanted to have boundary in here, I guess, we'd just add the disk. But anyway, in some sense, that is the theory of closed surfaces. And you have to be a little bit careful. So everything is a connect sum of these three pieces, but the decomposition isn't unique. Obviously, you can have as many copies of the sphere as you want, and how many projective planes you have, well, you either have zero or you have non-zero. In high dimensions, things go wrong. So the deal is that in dimension 7, the 7 sphere is the connect sum of two exotic 7 spheres. So there are manifolds which are not diffeomorphic to the 7 sphere. They are homeomorphic to it. And in fact, there's 28 of them. And so the 7 sphere can be written, unfortunately, as a connect sum of pieces, and so it then can be decomposed as much as you want into pieces that are not the 7 sphere. So it's slightly miraculous that in three dimensions there's a uniqueness statement. So Kaneza, round about the 30s, proved that a closed manifold has a prime decomposition. So he established the existence of prime decompositions. This was mentioned by Dave in the first lecture, but I'll say it again. There are two notions. The notion of prime, it means you're not a connect sum. So manifold is prime means you're not a connect sum, well, not in a non-trivial way. You're always a connect sum with the three sphere. So you're not a non-trivial connect sum. And there's the seemingly almost the same notion of irreducible. And irreducible means that every sphere bounds a ball. And there's a subtle difference here which is important when you come to the uniqueness. And this is one of the sad facts of mathematics, that the terminology is backwards. And so here we have that... I get this backwards. Irreducible implies prime. And normally in mathematics, in algebra, actually it's the other way. Prime implies irreducible. And prime implies irreducible, except for a couple of exceptions. And the exceptions are the circle times the sphere and the twisted product of the circle and the sphere. So with that minor irritation, prime and irreducible are the same. And now the Milner, around about 1960, proved an analogous statement to this one for surfaces. He found the non-uniqueness, the kind of non-uniqueness thing. So Milner showed that the prime decomposition, and here I'm dealing with a closed manifold, it needn't be orientable. The prime decomposition.
Can I just
start
with three manifolds?
Yeah. A closed three manifold, sorry.
Yeah.
So closed three manifold is a prime decomposition. And of course, a closed seven manifold in the smooth setting, well, it doesn't. It depends how you. The prime decomposition, Milner showed that the pieces are unique. So Kaneza tells you can chop up a three-manifold into prime pieces. And Milner tells you that they're unique modulo something that looks like this. And the point is, so the non-uniqueness is S1 times S2 plus the twisted version of that is the same as two copies of the twisted version. Of course, if you're in the orientable setting, then in fact you have unique on the nose. So the point is that this guy is not orientable. So if you stick with the orientable things, then the pieces you get are unique. However, there's another proviso. You can cut this up, the pieces you get are unique. But the way you cut it up is not unique. And so I'll explain this a bit more in a moment. It's not unique. This way of decomposing is not unique. It's not unique up to isotropy. The spheres you use to cut along aren't unique in a reasonable way. So it's not unique up to isotropy. So I'll explain this a bit more with the JSJ decomposition. So the kind of Thurston approach, the Thurston conjecture is that you can, given a closed manifold, you first take the prime decomposition, and then from the prime decomposition you take the JSJ decomposition, and the JSJ decomposition is unique. And then Thurston conjectured that the pieces are geometric. Again, Dave described this. First of all, there's the notion of torus decomposition, where you cut along tori and into pieces. And it's possible for people to disagree at this point, you cut along toroid into pieces which are either, well, the conventional definition is Seifert fiber space, SFS, or hyperbolic. But then a small minority of us would like to say, or it makes sense to say, you've got a solved manifold. Which is another way of saying that it's a bundle, well, it's an orbifold bundle with generic fiber, a torus. So this is a minor point, but in some sense it makes sense not to cut open a torus bundle to get a torus times interval, because a torus bundle is perfectly fine. Now then, that's what a torus decomposition is, and there are lots of ways to cut up a manifold into pieces like this. And the problem is the Seifert-fibred pieces. An example of a Seifert-fibred piece is the Cartesian product of a surface and a circle. You can cut up a surface in many different ways into simpler pieces. And so you can cut up the product into Seifert fiber spaces and get different pieces. So there's kind of no uniqueness here. So the JSJ decomposition, and JSJ stands for Jaco, Shalen, and Johansson. So Jaco and Shalen are one person, or they're two people who work together, and Johansson did it independently. The JSJ decomposition is that you use the least number of tori. So amongst all ways of taking a torus decomposition, pick one where you can use the fewest tori to end up with this desirable conclusion. And then you get the uniqueness theorem, which is that the JSJ decomposition is unique up to isotopy. So not only are the pieces you get unique, but the tori you use to do the cutting, they're unique as well. Well, modulo the trivial thing of pushing them a bit. So this is a kind of stronger uniqueness than the Milner uniqueness, where the spheres are not unique.
So we started with something prime?
Yeah. So M prime. Thanks. And by...
What's the one case three besides a genuine bundle with fiber torus?
Two twisted eye bundles over a torus, so a semi-bundle. Eye bundles over a torus. So it's double covered by torus times interval. It's double covered by a solved manifold. It's a quotient of a solved manifold by an involution. And there are two tori in the middle, which map to themselves.
So the fiber is still a torus?
You get two exceptional fibers that are Klein... Oh, yeah, I said the wrong thing. Two twisted eye bundles over Klein bottles. So there are two exceptional fibers that are Klein bottles. And in between... So you've got a bundle over... An orbifold bundle over an interval. The end fibers are Klein bottles, and the regular fibers in between are tori. And it's twofold covered by the torus bundle.
So the things in three are compact by themselves. Is that right?
The things in three are compact by themselves, yeah.
So we don't need a separate JSJ theorem for that, depending on whether we allow that or not.
No. It's kind of... I almost wish I hadn't said it.
Yeah. How can you not allow that? We either get that or you don't.
Yeah, actually, in a dimension lower, it would be the case, do you think of the torus as a torus, or do you cut open the torus along a circle and think of it as an annulus with the ends identified? Your choice. So that's the kind of the three-dimensional analogue of that. Do you think of a solve bundle? Well, I'm going to cut open along another torus because I can and end up with torus times interval with some identifications or whatever. So now I want to talk about graph manifolds and the role they play in Ricci flow and geometrization. So this is unfortunate. There are two definitions of graph manifold in the literature, and in some sense the first one, due to Waldhausen in 1968, is the right one, and that's the one I'm going to give. And the other one, which requires the tori to be incompressible, is in some sense the wrong one. So what is a graph manifold? Answer, it's anything... So a graph is a three-manifold. So that's a graph three manifold, and it's anything you can make by taking some circle bundles. It's a union of circle bundles, and you, so a circle bundle has boundary consisting of tori, and you glue these circle bundles together along boundary tori. So glue along boundary tori.
You're lying. What do you mean bundles?
No. These are honest. These are manifold. So that's a kind of general statement. Philosophically, that's pleasing because I just said circle bundles. In fact, you can restrict yourself to just a few kinds of circle bundle. In fact, you can say all you need is the circle times the disk, the pair of pants times the circle times a pair of pants are, so P here is pants, it's not projective plane. Disk sphere with three holes. And the twisted circle bundle over the Möbius band. So if you want, you can just use those circle bundles. You get the same notion of graph manifold. So Wolfhausen classified these, and it turns out, of course, the notion of geometric structures on three manifolds didn't exist when he did this work. And it's kind of subsequently, it's been realized that this is the notion of graph manifold is crucial. And so there are a few facts about graph manifolds. The first one is that if M is a closed manifold, then it can be decomposed as a graph manifold together with a hyperbolic manifold. The graph manifold and hyperbolic manifold might both have many pieces. So, and they're glued together, they're stuck together along tori. So every manifold, every closed manifold can be made by gluing some hyperbolic bits to some graph manifolds. And G and N are unique. So the graph bit, so if you have a closed manifold, it makes sense to talk about the hyperbolic bit, and it makes and the graph bit. Okay. And if M is irreducible, then one even has stronger uniqueness. You have isotropy uniqueness. So how you decompose it into a graph piece and a non-graph bit. Sorry?
Is the graph piece the same as the characteristics of
a manifold? Very nearly. A graph manifold is a connect sum of Seifert. The next theorem will answer it. In the irreducible case, what was your question again?
Is G the characteristics of a manifold?
In the irreducible case, it is the character. No. The three. So a spherical manifold is not. Oh, wait a minute, that's Seifert fiber. Yeah, no, it is. Okay, yes. The answer is yes, I think. The answer is yes. I think in the irreducible case, the graph thing is just if I said things right, in the irreducible case, the graph submanifold agrees with the when you take the JSJ decomp. Actually, okay. No, okay. When you take a JSJ decomposition, you get lots of pieces. And each piece is either cipher-fibred or hyperbolic, or if you're me, it's solved as well. Here you've done less cutting. So for example, if you have two cipher-fibred pieces that are glued together in an incompatible way so the cipher fibrings don't match, that's still a graph manifold. And if you want to take the JSJ decomposition, you'd cut further. So this is a less... You cut along fewer tori to get this decomposition. So hopefully the next theorem will clarify this. So a manifold is graph if and only if it has a Thurston decomposition. So I'll define this, I guess, in a minute. It has a Thurston decomposition with no hyperbolic pieces. So in particular, it can be cipher-fibered pieces glued together in incompatible ways. And that's the same thing as saying M collapses with bounded curvature. So this is the Chiga-Gromov theory that is important in the work of Hamilton and Perelman. So let me state the geometrization conjecture, and in the process say what I mean by a Thurston decomposition. So this is either the geometrization conjecture or it's a theorem. And it's due to Thurston, or it's due to Hamilton, Perelman, and a lot of topologists. And what it says is that if M is closed, and the word orientable appears, although it shouldn't, implies that M has a prime decomposition into pieces. And these pieces that you've just decomposed into, so these which have a JSJ decomposition into even smaller pieces, and each of these smaller pieces is has a Thurston geometry, one of the eight Thurston geometries. So when I talk about a Thurston decomposition, what I actually mean is this. So this is what I mean by a Thurston decomposition. You can cut it apart into geometric pieces. So the geometrization conjecture or theorem just says every closed orientable three manifold has a geometric decomposition. I've been talking about uniqueness. So in order to classify, you know, you want to produce a list of manifolds, you can do that. You then want to be able to recognize if a manifold is on the list. How does the geometry help you do that? Well, in the important case of hyperbolic geometry, the hyperbolic structure is unique. But in most of the other cases, there are moduli. So in general, the statement is, if you take the Thurston geometries on here, the geometries in general are not unique. On the other hand, the topological decomposition is unique. So you have to be a little bit careful about what the uniqueness is. I've got a note here that says to talk about a four-manifold collider. So what is physics? I don't know, but you have superstrings and their surfaces, and I presume a collider smashes surfaces into other surfaces. But you can imagine a collider that smashes three manifolds into other three manifolds, and you come to me and say, you know, we just got this three manifold from our three manifold collider. Is it the new missing, you know, manifold number 118? And I look through my list, I say, no, we've got it here. That's because I can recognize three manifolds. But if you build a four-manifold collider, and you come in one day with a new four-manifold, I say, I've never seen it before, I'll put it on the wall. And then you come in next week with another four-manifold, everything I try computing about it, all the invariants might be the same, but there's no way of knowing in general if they're the same or not. And so the point of this story somehow is that you really care about the recognition problem, as well as, I mean, there's no classification possible of four manifolds.
Is this because of the unsolvable
work? Because of the unsolvable, yeah, because every finitely presented group is the fundamental group of a four manifold. And you can't even tell if two groups are the same. So there's no way of telling then if two four manifolds are the same.
But what you're saying is also true for simply connected four manifolds in terms of the state of the art.
Yeah.
In terms of the state of the art, you bring in two four manifolds and
four
manifolds are the same.
So, I mean, is it conceivable that the space-time four manifold we live in is something that's kind of undecidable? That, you know, it's some object, but we can't know what it is. We match all the microwave radiation up, we get this thing, and then decide, well, it could be CP2, or it could be a fake CP2, but we can't figure it out.
There's a vast landscape of possibilities.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
I mean, it's physics, these things are not all conserved.
Yeah, so. So the last thing I want to do is to talk about. Collapse with bounded curvature. I'll have to make this up. So the Ricci flow, if you're lucky, proves the geometrization of three manifolds. But it does not do it in the way you would hope by producing a geometry on the three manifold. A similar issue arises in something called the orbifold theorem. You want to prove that a manifold or an orbifold has a geometric structure. And the way you would hope to do that would be to have some process that produces it. But in both the orbifold theorem and the Ricci flow program, well, if you're lucky and the manifold's hyperbolic, Ricci flow produces the hyperbolic metric. And if you're lucky, the manifold's spherical, it might produce a spherical metric, but I don't think anybody knows. But in the for the cases of the other geometry, as far as I know, nobody even pretends that the Ricci flow produces the geometry, because in fact what happens is the geometry collapses to something lower dimensional. And the way you rescue anything from this is to use the fact proved by Cheeger and Gromov that manifolds that collapse in a certain way, keeping their curvature bounded, are exactly graph manifolds. And we know what they all are. So I want to talk a bit about why graph manifolds are the manifolds that can collapse with bounded curvature. So I need to say a little bit about this. So M is an N-manifold, and it collapses with bounded curvature. What this means is, it means that there is a sequence of Riemannian metrics on N satisfying two conditions. The first condition is that all curvatures, all sectional curvatures, are never bigger than 1. And the second condition is that at every point in the manifold, the injectivity radius goes to 0. The manifold is kind of squeezing down everywhere. So an example of this we did last time is in dimension 2 if you take the torus. Because you can think of that as a unit circle times a circle of radius epsilon. And so such a torus actually has curvature 0, and it's collapsing. And in the limit, the Gromov-Hausdorff limit, talked about last time, is a circle. So here's a sequence of metrics on a surface. The curvature is always 0. As you go along in this family, the curvature, the injectivity radius is going to 0 everywhere. You end up with something lower dimensional. Cheeger and Gromov proved an amazing theorem that describes the topology of manifolds that collapse. And in dimension 3, it turns out that a manifold can collapse with bounded curvature if and only if it's a graph manifold.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I just got it. You're saying it's a collapse where the curvature is...
Zero.
Zero, right?
Like,
so the Ricci flow would not do anything.
Yeah. So this is, I'm not talking just about Ricci flow. Any sequence of metrics at all, you just invent any metrics on this guy. If you manage to find metrics where the curvatures go to stay bounded and the injectivity radius goes to zero. So this is a more general thing. And the point is that in Ricci flow, this can happen. You can... presumably get the Ricci flow can produce metrics that are doing this, although it wouldn't on the torus, you're right, it would stay stationary and not evolve at all. So let me do another example. So the three sphere collapses. So the three sphere is a graph manifold, and I'm going to show how it can collapse. So there's a family of metrics on the three-sphere. The way a geometer... So for the geometers in the audience, you take the standard RAND metric on the three-sphere, and then you rescale it so that along the hop vibration, the circles get shorter and shorter. And the miracle there is a calculation shows that the curvature remains bounded when you do that. And you get this sequence of metrics on the three-sphere that limit on the two-sphere. But I'm a topologist and I don't understand that, so I'm going to draw a picture instead. And so you take a balloon. So a balloon is a surface with a particular kind of metric on it. This is a balloon. And this is a circle of length epsilon. It's a very short circle. And this balloon, its curvature is everywhere less than 1. Actually, it's got negative curvature here. And it's got positive curvature there. But so if you make this very, very short, the balloon is actually going to have to be very big, otherwise you'll have a lot of curvature. So there's a metric on a surface. In fact, the surface here, topologically, it looks a bit funny, but it's just a disk. Now I'm going to take the product of that in a metric sense with another circle of circumference epsilon. So now I've got a metric on a solid torus. And that metric near the boundary is a very simple metric, actually. The metric near the boundary is here. The metric is near the boundary is a product. It's a square torus times an interval. Well, so now I'm going to take another balloon. Same thing. And product it again with a short circle. And I'm going to glue them together. Now, there's an obvious way to glue them together. And the obvious way to glue them together, if you just glue the boundary of this balloon, you've got a two-sphere, and you product with a circle. The obvious way of gluing together gives you the product of a sphere and a circle. And I don't want to do that. This manifold obviously collapses, because after all, you can put your standard metric on the two-sphere and make this circle as small as you want. Instead, I'm going to glue these two things together with a 90-degree twist. In other words, what I've got is the boundary of this balloon times a circle is a torus, and it's a square torus, and the boundary of this one is also a square torus. And I'm going to glue them together so that the curves on one get switched and get glued to the curves on the other like this. This is what I mean by a 90-degree twist. And this is something called the genus 1 Heegaard splitting of the three sphere. In particular, this way of gluing two copies of a solid torus together gives you the three sphere. And now I've just shown you a sequence of metrics that collapse on the three sphere. And there the curvature, the injectivity radius here. So the injectivity radius is epsilon everywhere, because through every point there's a circle of length epsilon coming from this circle factor. So the injectivity radius is everywhere a very small number epsilon going to zero, and the manifold's collapsing with bounded curvature. And actually, if you think about it, this same trick is going to work to prove every graph manifold collapses with bounded curvature. Because after all, what is a graph manifold? Well, you take a surface bundle, you take a circle bundle over a surface. In fact, you can take just simple bundles. You can take a torus, you can take a disc times a circle, or a pair of pants times a circle, or a Mobius band times a circle. And you can do this trick with them. The only catch is that when you glue, this trick of doing a 90 degree twist isn't going to work. In general, for a graph manifold, you've got one circle bundle and another circle bundle, and you've got to glue two tori together by an arbitrary diffeomorphism, by an arbitrary element of SL2Z. And so the trouble with doing that is that you're not going to be able to glue this torus to this torus with an isometry. And so you have to adjust the metric. And the danger is that when you adjust the metric, the curvature goes to infinity. But in fact, you can avoid that because... So imagine, for example, here we've got a very small torus. We've got a square torus, which is a product of two circles of radius epsilon. And over here we've got the same thing, only we want to glue them together in a complicated way. So, for example, this curve maybe has to be identified with a curve that goes, I don't know, seven times around one direction, once around the other, some complicated way. So the idea is you take a product metric and you take a very long product metric from 0 to L, and as you travel in this direction, you just start changing the Euclidean metric on this torus very slowly until you move it in moduli space or Titmuller space over to the metric here. And if you do that slowly enough and this length is long enough, you can keep the curvature under control. And so in that way you see that you can put a metric on any graph manifold where the curvature is less than one everywhere and the injectivity radius is as small as you want everywhere. So every graph manifold collapses with bounded curvature. That's easy. The amazing theorem of Cheeger and Gromov, so this dates back to around 1980, and they prove a theorem in all dimensions which is technical to state. So this is their collapsing theorem. But what they prove is, what it boils down to is in dimension 3, if a closed three manifold, collapses with bounded curvature, the hard direction is, then it is a graph manifold. And the kind of idea of their proof is very simple. I mean, if the manifold's collapsing, through every point, you've kind of got a preferred direction, because if the manifold's collapsing, the injectivity radius is getting very small. So at a point, you've got a very short loop. And if you're lucky, these kind of short loops kind of vary continuously as you go around the manifold, and you've got the manifold foliated by short loops. And then you'd have a Seifert fiber space or a circle bundle. But actually, as you move around, the geometry changes very slowly. And so what is the short loop kind of changes. And so you kind of get a structure where the manifold on a kind of intermediate scale is locally a circle bundle. But then it gets glued to another circle bundle over here. And there's a transition area where actually you've got two shortest loops. And so in fact you've got small tori. And so that's kind of roughly how the collapsing theorem goes.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
What happens if you throw solid geometry into
Ricci-Ford?
Do you know what it does?
Well, because it's a homogeneous space, you could write down, I think, exactly what happens. And in solved geometry, there are directions of positive and negative curvature. So the directions of positive curvature will shrink.
So there's a bit of literature on this. Solved geometry is the only one where there isn't a Ricci soliton. So Ricci soliton, in general, you allow a diffeomorphism to correct for your expansion. And so people have looked at different starting metrics on a solved manifold and found that it doesn't always... I mean, there's no obvious attractor.
What about the easier case in mill geometry? What happens there?
In mill geometry, there's an attractor.
But the attractor, I assume, is one of these... Fitzroy metrics? It's not a Riemannian metric, is that right? It's just that.
I mean, there's some people who wrote some very concrete comments, and that doesn't sound simpler or happier. That's the best business.
I remember saying one thing about Saul where one of their base directions was expanded and the rest just sit there at the time. Jameson does not retract it.
Yeah, so if you start with a metric that is close to one of these homogeneous metrics, you can probably analyze what's going to happen. But if you start with an arbitrary metric...
No, I meant exactly homogeneous.
Yeah, no, in the homogeneous case, you could say exactly what happens, because the I think you end up with an ODE or a couple of ODEs in the homogeneous case. And I'm guessing, I mean, it must collapse, actually, to either... Actually, I bet it collapses to a circle, would be my guess. That would be my guess. I think I've said everything that was advertised.
Thanks very much. So just a word about organization. The next couple weeks, Mike Friedman is going to give some lectures about...
I'll send you a...
Universal manifold pairings, and
I'll send you an abstract.
There will be an abstract to read. And then at some point, so one question is whether we would like to meet on Veterans Day or not. It's an official university holiday. Some people might be away. Is there any sentiment? One way or the other?
When is Veterans Day?
November 10th.
Oh.
Okay.
Was anyone going anywhere?
Nobody's got a life.
Okay. Why don't we decide next week?
Sure.
They can decide how bad the lecture is.
Yes, I agree.